Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for listening to a special 9/11 episode of Lauren Interviews. This day is just so tough for so many people, and I really just wanted to make sure that Americans don't forget this day. We should never forget the men and women that lost their lives that day, the men and women that were heroes and saved others. So with that being said, I feel so fortunate that I was able to interview former NYPD Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick. So Commissioner Carrick was the 40th commissioner of the NYPD from 2000 to 2001, and he was there on that day with Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and Commissioner Carrick just walked me through that day, everything he saw and everything that happened after. It was tragic, it was messy, it was horrific, and that ultimately led to this country becoming more united than it ever has before. So grab your tissues and sit back and listen to Commissioner Carrick's story. And, you know, I had a really hard time holding it together. I tried to mute myself a few times because I end up just sobbing uncontrollably when he's telling me some of these things that he witnessed, and it just, you know, it just really, really gets you. So without further ado, here's my interview with former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Carrick.
Most weight loss plans are one size fits all, not taking into account each person's individual needs. Noom is built for your psychology and your biology, meeting you where you are. Noom Weight uses psychology. That's why they say losing weight starts with your brain, but it also takes into account your unique biological factors, which also affect weight loss success. The program helps you understand the science behind your eating choices and why you have cravings. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available for pre-order wherever books are sold.
And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
In your experience, could you just take me through, I guess, that morning, like when you woke up? I'm just trying to have you set the tone for just a regular day, of what you thought was a regular day.
Well, as police commissioner, my regular day started around 6 in the morning. I would get a call from Mayor Giuliani around 6:05, and he would want to know what was going on, what happened last night over the last 24 hours. And we talk about everything that happened between the last time I spoke to him, which was usually between 11 at night and 2 in the morning. So I got my call that morning. I went to my office. I got downtown around 7, and I had a gym, half of a gym, really, and a treadmill in the rear of my office, and I went back there and I worked out, and around 8:30, I went in to take a shower, and I was standing in the bathroom taking a shave, and my chief of staff started banging on the outside door, and I walked out, and I actually yelled at him. I said, "What are you doing? Why are you making all this noise? What's going on?"
Yeah.
He said, "Commissioner, a plane just hit Tower 1. I said, "Okay, you know, relax, calm down. because I thought I would eventually learn that a twin engine Cessna or one of these puddle jumpers that fly up and down the Hudson River, I thought that's what he was talking about, which would be tragic, yes, but it would be no different than a car accident in New York City, and we have those all day long. I turned around, and after I spoke to him, and I looked up at a television in my office, and I could see one of the newsreels running this stream of the towers, and I could see the damage, and I knew at that point that it was not a twin-engine Cessna or any small aircraft.
Right.
So I walked out of my office. I went into my conference room. I pulled back the drapes, and Police Plaza headquarters, New York City Police headquarters, was about a half mile from the towers. And I could see the top of the building clearly. And I started looking at the building, and I could see the damage to the, you know, 95th floor and above of that building. I went back into my office to my desk, grabbed the phone, called the mayor, told him I would meet him at Seven World Trade, which was our command center, the city's command center. It was in that building on the 23rd floor. So the mayor said he would meet me there in about 10 minutes. He was coming from uptown. And I was downtown, went to Seven World Trade. I got down there within about 8 minutes. And as we arrived and was turning on Vesey Street from West Broadway, there were a bunch of cops there. They stopped my motorcade. And the sergeant came up to the window and said, "Commissioner, we can't, you can't turn onto the block. They're jumping." And I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know what he meant. So I got out of the car and I said, What's going on? And I walked to the corner and I was watching this debris come down off the building. And I didn't realize until that debris got closer to the ground that it wasn't debris, it was actual bodies. And I watched over the next several minutes, I don't know, maybe two dozen people jump to their deaths, you know, some one, two, three at a time. We backed the vehicles up West Broadway to Barclay Street. And I called the mayor's detail and told them to meet me at Barclay and West Broadway. We couldn't get into Tower 7. And about 3 minutes before the mayor actually arrived, there was this enormous explosion above me. And I looked up, and it was the north side of Tower 2 blowing out over West Broadway. So when you see that big, when you watch the footage today of the attack on that day, when you see that big orange fireball blow out the north side of Tower 2, I'm standing under that building looking up at it. Wow. And then over the next, you know, minute and a half, all of that debris, the plane parts, the building, body parts, they basically came down on top of us. And I hid behind the post office there, right across from Tower 7. I hid behind that building until the debris stopped falling.
I mean, what were you thinking in that moment? Not to be cliche, but I mean, how long were you behind there?
I was back there. I was behind the building until the debris basically stopped, you know, showering down on the street.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 30 seconds or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any idea what that was. I remember later one of my guys said that I was screaming and yelling that they're blowing up the buildings.
Okay.
Because I didn't see that second plane. That second plane came in from the southern end of Manhattan. It went down along the Hudson River, turned back to left, came back north, hit the tower on the north side, on the south side, and came through the tower on the north side. So I didn't see the plane. And it wasn't until I came out from behind the building, I could hear our helicopter pilots, the aviation unit, the NYPD's aviation unit, who was actually up in the air already. I could hear them yelling into the microphones, that a second aircraft had just struck Tower 2. They were calling into Central saying a second airplane just hit Tower 2.
And remind me of what time this was.
The second aircraft hit Tower 2 at 9.02 a.m.
Yeah,
9.02 a.m.
Okay. Right. And then at what point did you and the mayor actually, I guess, I don't even know what you would call this. Like, how do you even form a plan of action based on what you're seeing when you're so confused, right?
Well, you know, the plan of action normally would be go to the Office of Emergency Management and manage the crisis, right? We now had no Office of Emergency Management. We now knew that it was an attack on the country. So my first instinct, as basically the, you know, the person in charge of the security of the city was, what's next? One,
yeah.
Are there any more planes?
Sure.
How much of the airspace can we control? How many, what are the next possible targets? I can remember yelling at my guys, close down the airspace and get me air support. And it became a joke later because about a week later, we were sitting up at Pier 92 mm-hmm. at one of the command stations. And my chief of staff looked over at me smiling. I said, what are you laughing at? I was just thinking about that day. He said, when you started screaming at me to get me air support and shut down the airspace, he said, and you turned around to do something, and I looked at the guys, you know, the bodyguards, and I was like, what is there, like, who am I supposed to call? What is there, an 800 number for
right.
the U.S. Air Force? Like,
right. You know, yeah.
What the hell are you talking about? It's a police department. I don't have aircraft.
Yeah,
but that's,
totally.
That gives you an idea of what the mindset was, right?
Yeah.
You know, close the airspace down, give me air support. The mass transit system, we ordered shut down immediately. I was concerned that there would be attacks on the ground. Mm-hmm. I was concerned for a mass transit attack, possibly, you know, what about a sarin gas drop like they did in Japan? Something like that. So there were all these things going through my mind. And we didn't have nowhere to command from. So we had lost Tower 7. So the mayor arrived about 3 minutes after that plane hit Tower 2. We went down to a temporary command post they had set up on the West Side Highway. And the deputy chief of the fire department, the chief of the fire department, the first deputy commissioner of the fire department, they were all there. We met with them. We talked about the damage to the two buildings. And then I was taking the mayor back to 75 Barclay Street. It was a small Merrill Lynch office. It was on that corner where I initially met him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking him there because he wanted to call the president. So we went back. He called the White House. He asked to speak to the president. They said, the president's not in. The vice president's going to come and get on the phone and speak to you. And within about 60 seconds after he was told that, somebody came on the phone, spoke to him, and he hung up the phone, looked at me, and he said, oh, my God, this isn't good. And I said, what is it? He says, I think they just said they believe the Pentagon's been attacked and they're evacuating the White House, and they hung up. And as he said those words, the building we were in began to shake like a freight train was coming through it. And Joe Esposito was my chief of department for the NYPD. He slammed open the door to that office. The door slammed open. He stepped in. And he said, it's coming down. And I thought he meant our building, the building we were in.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, he wasn't talking about our building. He was talking about Tower 2, which was, keep in mind, it was only 2.5 blocks south of us. That
but
building
you felt
was
it. You felt it shaking,
oh, no,
though.
We felt it like we were in it.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
It was just like we were in it. That
Commissioner.
Building came...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but in this moment, and as Mayor Giuliani said this to you, and as the building is shaking, I mean, I'm just trying to get your feeling, because you are so even and you are so strong, but were you terrified?
You know, I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny because when that thing was happening, right, the building's coming down, our building's like, we believe it's us, you know.
Yeah.
There were a lot of, you know, a lot of the guys, like, they were jumping on their desks, and they were, and I was standing in a doorway looking at the mayor, who was sitting at a desk and had been on the phone with the White House. Hmm. And basically, I put my hands up on the side of that door, and I just held on to the side of the door. And the mayor teased me later, and he said, "How come you didn't get down?" And I started laughing. I said, "You don't actually think one of those desks were going to protect anybody if the damn building fell on top of us here?" I said, "Are you kidding me? Like, there's nothing in that building that would stop anything. You know, you couldn't have hid anywhere."
Yeah, right. Right.
So the building was flushed immediately when Tower 2 imploded. Keep in mind, it came down two blocks south of us,
okay. But
it was all over us. It was on top of our building. It was outside the building. And this will give you an idea of how bad it was. Joe Dunn, my first deputy, was in a Dodge minivan because he had severed his Achilles tendon on his foot. His Dodge minivan was about a foot high. About a foot high.
Okay.
By the time all the debris came down. That's
Oh my gosh.
Right.
Oh my God.
The vehicle was completely crushed. The stuff around us was crushed. Tower 2 was on fire. Tower 7 was on fire, I mean.
Wow.
Tower 2 had imploded. Tower 1 was on fire. And then we're stuck inside 75 Barclay Street in all this dust and debris and gas and smoke. And I remember thinking, like, all the stuff I've done in my life. You know, I've been in gun battles, I've been stabbed, I've been shot at, I've had partners killed. All the stuff I've done, but I'm going to die in this room because I can't breathe. I mean, I was, you know, we were suffocating. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this room, we heard these doors opening next to us. And I looked over, and these two Spanish maintenance guys came through a door with a bunch of keys. And he was as shocked to see us, especially being that they're standing there with the mayor now.
Yeah, yeah.
Shocked to see us as we were to see them. And I asked one of the guys, I said, "Do you have keys through these doors, the inside doors?" Because we couldn't get out the way we came in. He says, "Yes, sir." So he started opening the doors. We went through a maze of tunnels, and we came out. Actually, we came out on Church Street, inside the building 100 Church. That's how we got out of the danger zone.
Wow. I mean, and how many of you were together at that moment?
So it was me, the mayor, my first deputy, Joe Dunn, Joe Esposito, the chief of department, Tom Von Essen, the fire commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, our security staff, the mayor's security, my security staff, the mayor's security staff, they were all in there with us. Joe Loda, the deputy mayor, was with us. We were all in that office together.
And everybody survived, everyone from that office.
In that office, yeah. Everybody that was in the office was able to get out. You know, it was definitely, you know, it was a rough time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then once you're out, and, you know, I can only imagine you're seeing the streets of New York City and you're seeing all of the chaos. And it's kind of like, where do you even begin?
No, you know what, Lauren, this is an odd this is an odd thing that people have asked me what was the strangest, some of the worst or the strangest things, right?
Yeah.
Watching people jump to the death was one of them. But this is what I'm about to tell you is one of the strangest things of that day. We came out on Church Street into the lobby of 100 Church. And when we got into that lobby, that building, the first floor of that building where we were, the windows are from ground up. So they're about 15 foot high, but they're from the ground up. The entire lobby is glass. As we got into that lobby, I knew that lobby because Corporation Council for the city was in that building. I had been there dozens of times. But when I got into the lobby, I immediately noticed you couldn't see anything outside the glass. Those glass windows were completely white. Like somebody took a sheet and put them across those windows. There was no view outside. We couldn't see anything. So I went over to the door. They had those revolving doors in that building. I went to the door. I pushed the door, and the door was, it was really difficult to move. And I looked down, and there was about maybe a half an inch to three quarters of an inch of dust on the ground. And I pushed through that, got through that door, made it to the outside, and there was no sound. There was completely no sound. It was like somebody put you in a soundproof box.
Oh.
It was the weirdest, strangest thing. Like, I'm telling you, of that day, that was one of the weirdest moments for me. When we got outside,
yeah,
all sound was gone. No, there was no, you couldn't even hear sirens.
And it wasn't your hearing from maybe being like blown out somehow. It was definitely, there was nothing outside.
No, there was nothing outside. The dust and the debris had basically muffled the air or something. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah.
But it was just like you walked through that door and somebody put headphones on you and there was no sound. Nothing. Yeah. Like no movement, no trees, no birds, no nothing. Gone. Done. So that was pretty strange.
That is so creepy. Oh my gosh, that is so creepy. Seriously. So
we actually between the dust and that thing, that no sound thing.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of the guys saying, was this a new, what is this? Is there a nuclear blast? What was that?
Yeah.
You know, because nobody understood what was going on.
Right. Right. I mean, you mentioned, I guess, of, you know, all the things that you've been through in your life, you've been shot at, you've been stabbed. I mean, you've been through a lot and you've seen a lot in your life. You know, I'm sure I can't even imagine what you've seen. And, you know, when you were in Saudi Arabia and, then you're watching people essentially jump to their death. I mean, I imagine that's something that really stays with you forever.
Well, listen, there's plenty of things about that day, you know, that day, the weeks, the months after.
Yeah.
I think the worst part of that day is my arriving there, seeing these people jump to the deaths. I think another part of that day came around 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. I was with the mayor for the morning. We got him settled. When we were in that building on Church Street, we left that building. A bunch of the mayor's staff wanted him to go back to City Hall, which was also, we didn't know it at the time, but it was saturated with this dust and all this debris. I told the mayor he's not going to City Hall. We didn't know if there were other attacks planned. We didn't know what could happen downtown. I was worried about the United Nations, the Empire State Building. I didn't think it was safe for the mayor to go back to City Hall at the time. So I picked the New York City Police Academy, which was up on 20th Street. It was concealed within Gramercy Park. Nobody knew That was a nondescript building. I said, okay, we're going to get the mayor. We're going to put him in the academy. And he could run shop from the academy until we solidify and secure the city. So that's basically what we began to do. We got him up to the academy. Then him and I, we got in our vehicles, and I remember going to St. Vincent's Hospital on 7th Avenue. He wanted to see the casualties. He wanted to see the survivors. That was the second strangest thing for the day, and that was pulling up in front of St. Vincent's and seeing all these doctors and nurses sitting outside, sitting on the curbs, sitting on gurneys, all these gurneys lined up side by side, and nobody was doing anything. And the mayor literally got out of the truck, and he went up to a doctor, and he goes, "How are you guys okay? You know, what's going on? It's, you know, how many survivors are there?" And the doctor basically said, "There's no one. We're not getting anyone."
And we knew with that, gosh,
that it was, the death toll was going to be bigger than we anticipated. There was nobody. I mean, they had nobody. All these nurses and doctors were like sitting on the curb next to their gurneys. And there were like 20, 30 gurneys outside St. Vincent's.
I don't know enough, but I assume people were treated earlier in the day that had a chance of survival, right? Or, you know what I mean? I guess by that time, it's so late that no one's being transported, because if they're found under a building or in all that debris, chances are they're dead.
Yeah, no, nobody survives. No one, if you were in the building.
Yeah.
When the building imploded, you died. There were no survivors, zero, none.
Right.
People that sustained injuries were people that were outside, people that were running, people that got hit by debris. You know, there were a number of people that died getting hit by debris. Father Michael Judge, the chaplain for the fire department, actually died. He was struck by a jumper.
That's insane. Are you serious? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
He was struck by a jumper?
Yeah. So, you know, that's, so you had all that, you know, there wasn't a lot of survivors. The survivors were people that weren't in the buildings, that were outside.
How many?
I remember.
Sorry, go ahead.
It was a lady that was coming up out of the subway. And she was like walking out of the subway, had no idea what was going on, and was hit with all this jet fuel and had no idea where it came from. So we went to St. Vincent's. We went to a couple of hospitals. It was the same thing in each hospital. And then around 5:30, 6 o'clock that night, I had gone back to my office in headquarters. And Joe Dunn, my first deputy, and Chief Esposito walked into my office and said, "Okay, Commissioner, we have 23 missing, and we have gathered up their family members, and they're down in the lobby, in the ceremonial. There's a ceremonial conference room, and you need to go down and talk to them." So I went downstairs, walked into that room, and I was shocked when I walked in there, because some of those family members I knew. You know, Joe Vigiano was a New York City detective. I had just promoted him a month or two prior to the attack. This is a guy that had been involved in two gun battles over a 4-year period, had been shot 5 times in those two gun battles, stayed on the job, got transferred to emergency service, loved the job. And when I walked into that room, I saw his father, who I knew, I walked over. His father said, you know, they told me Joe's missing. And before I could even say anything, he looked at me and he said, John's missing too. John was his other son, who was a firefighter. And Mr. Vigiano lost both of his sons that day. Joe Vigiano and his son, John. You know, what's crazy today is if you go to my Instagram account, and I posted these actually today, there are stories on my Instagram account. There's these two really handsome young New York City cops that are telling a story on my Instagram. And both of those cops, both of them are Joe's sons.
Thank God.
Joe Vigiano Jr. And James. And what's crazy for me today is when I watch them and I listen to them, I see their father. And then last time I physically saw them, was at their father's eulogy when they were 7 and 5 years old.
Oh my gosh. So
it's kind of strange.
Sorry. I'm like the worst, when it comes to this. I can't hold it together at all. I guess I sometimes look back on all of this and it makes you question God, and I hate questioning God. I hate it. I hate when I get like that. But when you say, you know, you've got this father that lost both of his sons, it's just really hard to swallow. It really is.
Well, and you know what, Lauren, we had two of those. We had, we had the Vigiano family, and we also had the Langone family. In fact, Kenny Langone, who was a good friend of mine, the chairman, he was once the chairman, the founder of Home Depot, one of the founders.
Wow.
Kenny Langone's two nephews. One was a fireman, one was a cop. Both of them died as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking. No matter how much time goes by, I will never not sob over this day. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Commissioner, there's a very iconic picture, and I love this picture. It's you and Mayor Giuliani and George Bush. And I believe it might be the fire chief. I'm not sure. But
yeah,
you're just,
about us.
What is it?
Yeah, it's, that photo is a pretty iconic. I'm sitting there staring at it in my office. That photo was actually taken at Ground Zero, across from 7 World Trade. Across from 75 Barclay Street. President Bush came to Ground Zero on September 14th, that Friday, and he wanted to go down to the pile. And he wanted to see the damage, and he met us on Barclay Street, right across from that Merrill Lynch office that the mayor was in when he was trying to call the president. And we were standing there, and he was looking at Tower 7, which also had imploded. And he was asking us all these questions about the damage and devastation. And that photo was taken by one of the PD photographers, John Boddy.
Yeah, I was looking for a credit because I also have it on my Instagram. So I was like trying to find, all of the information. And it's such an iconic photo. I mean, it's something that you just see everywhere all year, you know, no matter what. It's like every year. I'm sorry. It's iconic. And, you know, I guess after that period, I truly felt like Americans had never been more united. I feel like we've never been more divided now as a country. Everything seems so broken and so tough to wrap my head around. But I don't know, you know, what your feelings were after 9/11 to, you know, maybe what they are now, but, or if you agree with me.
You know what, Laura, I'm going to tell you, this is a true story, and it relates to that photo. And it also relates to exactly what you're talking about. So we were on that corner where that photo was taken. Mm-hmm. And when we got done briefing the president said, I want to go up to the Javits Center and meet with the family members of those missing. And the presidential motorcade was on Barclay Street, you know, 20 cars, Suburbans and all this stuff. And the president says, come on, you guys come with me. Well, it was me, Giuliani, Governor Pataki, who's a big guy, Richie Shearer, who was a heavy guy, and it was the president, and one more. Somebody else was with us. Oh, the mayor. So there's six of us. There's six of us, and the president says, get in the Suburban with him. Well, there's only two seats. You know, one seat for two, facing another seat for two, so it's technically four. Right. He said, come on, let's go. And I said, Mr. President, I said, no, boom, I'll jump. We'll jump in one of the backups. He said, no, everybody, come on, let's go. So we get into the back of the Suburban, literally, all six of us. We're stuffed in there like sardines. I literally, like I had my leg bent over the president's leg in the back of the car.
So funny.
And okay. We take off and we head toward the Javits Center. And we're going up the West Side Highway. And the president is looking out the window. And for anybody that was in New York City at that time, they'll remember, like, all these thousands of people that lined the West Side Highway, they had all these signs, you know, God bless America, go get him, Mr. President, God bless George Bush, all this stuff. And Bush looks out the window, and he's astonished at what he's looking at. And he says to Giuliani, he says, Rudy, he said, look at this. Look at all these people. He said, the unity is phenomenal. You know, all this stuff, they're so supportive. And Giuliani looks at the president half serious, like he just looks at him. He said, Mr. President, I hate to be the one to break this to you. Not one of those people voted for you.
And it is New York after all.
President burst out laughing. Everybody laughed. The guy that laughed the most was George Pataki. And Rudy looks at him and he goes, Governor, he goes, I wouldn't laugh because none of them voted for you either.
There you go.
We're on the west side of Manhattan, and I can assure you there are no Republicans or conservatives down on this side of Manhattan. But the gist of the story is, and this goes back to what you said, on September 11th, and in the weeks and months after, there was no Republican Party. There was no Democratic Party. There was no conservative versus liberal. There was none of that. It was the United States of America as one. And I often think back to those times when I look at what's going on in this country today, and you have to wonder, where the hell are all these people now? It was there. You know, where's the politicians? You know, for weeks, the mayor and I constantly, even over and above, you know, the response, the rescue, the recovery, the investigation, managing the crisis itself, dealing with crime reduction. On top of all of that, for weeks, we had to constantly take members of Congress on tours downtown to show them the damage, the devastation, what had happened, how it happened, where it happened. And I can remember all those people, all of them, crying and sniveling and you know, all this other stuff. And some of them are like, you know, they are what I consider America's worst enemies today. But back then, they were, you know, they were united, and many of them, you know, I know I'm going to get hammered for saying this, but they were cowards. They were cowards. They were scared to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see them today on, you know, doing these political rants and all this other stuff, you know, trying to personally, professionally, politically annihilate people. And I look back in the, during those times and I think, you know, how times have changed, you know. These were very different people 21, 22 years ago.
Yeah, I think you said it so beautifully, and I don't know how anyone could say it better than that in terms of there was no Republicans, there was no Democrats. It was just everybody. It was just the United States of America, and that's it. And, you know, I hope and pray that, yeah, we can get back to that. Go ahead.
But I, you know, what scares me, it was that way because they had no choice. It was that way because they were afraid. You know, I was talking to Andrew Giuliani this morning, Mayor Giuliani's son. And he asked me, you know, why or what I thought was the reason. And the reason, I think, you know, people were scared to death. You know, Rudy Giuliani, a man that, you know, was responsible for the most substantial crime reduction, violent crime and murder reductions in U.S. history. You know, he, and I'm not taking away anything from President Bush. President Bush did the job he had to do. But during those, during that first week, I can tell you that Rudy Giuliani was the pillar of strength for this entire country. Because the entire world was on him, and his leadership, his courage, his dedication, his perseverance, all of it made people feel safe. It was, you know, he made them understand, yes, this is bad. We've been attacked and it's bad, and it's not going to be easy. But we are going to survive. And you can't, you have no idea how many times, you know, all the time. This morning, I was in a diner with a New York City firefighter. And a guy come up to me and thank me for my service and what I did on September 11th. But he basically walked away. As he was walking away, he said, there's never been a time in my life that I felt safer than when I watched you and the mayor on TV in the aftermath of 9/11. He says, because I knew you guys were going to get us through that. Well, that was the mayor. That was the mayor, and he set the stage for what had to be done. And it got done. It got done better than any crisis that I've seen managed in this country. And it's that, that again is, you know, raises serious questions of motive and other things with regard to why and how Rudy's treated the way he is today.
100%. I mean, you nailed it. He did exhibit this bravery and this courage, and you're absolutely right. He had this gift that just made everybody feel so much better, right? Like somebody is taking care of you and you don't have, like you have to worry a bit, but you know, don't make yourself sick over it because the worst has happened and now we got this and we have to come together. So you're absolutely right. And, but also like, don't, you know, don't sell yourself short either. I mean, you, I hope you know that you're a hero and that you're always going to be a hero. And, you know, nobody can take that from you and nobody can take that from Mayor Giuliani. And that's for certain. So, I personally, I think about you guys all the time. You know, I think about September 11th a lot too. And I just think about how scared I would have been. I wasn't here yet. I didn't move here, but just knowing you guys, like I know you, I mean, I just feel so blessed to have you both in this city, you know, and have you both still involved. So I just want to say thank you. And I'm like crying like a loser, but anyway.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
No, Lord, yeah.
Let me just say this one thing, because I want your listeners to understand this. You know, people call the mayor hero and me a hero and all that stuff. you know, we did the best we could under the circumstances, but the real heroes are the men and women in the police department, the fire department, the Port Authority police, that realistically effected the greatest rescue mission in the history of this country. They took 20,000 to 25,000 people out of those buildings and the surrounding areas, and they evacuated. They evacuated more than a million people out of southern Manhattan into the four boroughs and into New Jersey in probably a matter of 8 hours without a problem. That's never been done in this country. It's unparalleled in crisis management. Hopefully it never has to happen again, but they were responsible for the greatest rescue mission in this nation.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because 100%, they are true heroes, and it's unfathomable bravery, if you will. I can't imagine, you know, what they were going through and what they went through during that mission, but you're absolutely right. So, thank you again. And just for people listening that might want to follow you on your platforms, do you mind just sharing them where they can find you?
Yeah. Any of the platform, it's my name, Bernard Kerik.
Oh, okay. Twitter,
you know, Instagram, they're all the same. I got one thing, you know, Bernard Kerik, one. That's it.
Yes. Absolutely. And you also, you contribute and you write for Newsmax as well, I believe. So they can find your articles there, which are really wonderful. I always enjoy reading them.
Thank you. Of course.
And again, thank you again. I know how tough this is to continue to tell your story and relive that day. So I appreciate you.
Laura, thank you. And thanks for taking the time to put this out there. I don't think, you know, when people say never forget, nobody believes that better than I do. So thanks for getting it out.
Of course. Of course.
And that was former NYPD Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik. That was so, so moving to me and just so incredible to be able to talk to him about that day firsthand. So I really appreciate him coming on and sharing that. And oh my gosh, I really can never, and I will never wrap my head around that day and how many people that we lost. So, with that being said, thank you everyone for listening and tuning into this special episode. If you like this podcast, don't forget to rate and subscribe on Apple, and there will be a new episode once again next week.